From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Retailers can't sell their coats. Blooming azaleas have been spotted in New York City's parks. This winter, there's been lots of talk about global warming, but not many people outside of the scientific community have heard about global dimming and how that contributes to climate change. With me now for the first of today's underreported features is David Travis, a climatologist at the University of Wisconsin. His research focuses on the impact of jet planes on climate change, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Travis to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Doesn't your research involve jet contrails? What are they?
Jet contrails, that's short for condensation trails, and its basic simple idea is it's the clouds that form when you inject warm air from the exhaust of the engines into a very cold atmosphere, similar to what happens on a cold day when you see your breath. The only difference is that once the contrail forms that high in the atmosphere, a lot of times there is additional moisture available, which then is sort of entrained onto the contrail, allows it to grow and persist, sometimes for as much as a couple hours.
Now, we see them when jets fly overhead, in many instances, not all. Are there certain conditions that would lead to larger contrails?
Yes. A lot of times we see these ahead of approaching storm systems or fronts, and it's sort of an indication that there's an increase in moisture occurring in the upper levels where the airplanes are flying, but often it's not sufficient to form natural clouds, and the airplanes sort of kickstart the cloud formation process by injecting additional moisture into a cold atmosphere, and also the particles that come out with the pollution act as surfaces for the clouds to form. And then if the atmosphere is very close or at 100% relative humidity but not yet producing natural clouds, it is able to take these artificially produced clouds and allow them to grow and persist, as I said, for many hours sometimes. Often days when it's very dry, crisp, clear days, you might see a contrail form, but it's very short-lived. It may just be a small distance behind the airplane before it evaporates, sublimates.
Well, everything you've said so far doesn't make them sound like they should be cause for real worry.
Well, I think it's something that a lot of us really don't notice. I'm probably one of the few that notices contrails from the moment of starting till often the moment of dissipation, as I tend to keep an eye on the skies, and I've studied contrails using satellite imagery where you can get a much better perspective. And you don't realize really how much coverage you get from contrails. We just did a recent study that calculated that the average on a daily basis, the average amount of contrail coverage across the United States, if you put it all together and bunched it in one area, it would be approximately the size of Montana.
And
that's pretty significant.
I assume that there are clusters of jet contrails in areas where there's a lot of jet traffic.
That's correct. Where I'm in the Midwestern Wisconsin, we tend to have a large density of contrail coverage, because one of the things that people have to realize is contrails aren't more common near airports. They're actually more common between airports when the airplanes are up at the 35,000-foot mark or so cruising. And here in the middle part of the United States, we tend to get that crisscross effect the most, and that's part of the reason we see the greatest amount of contrail coverage.
Did you notice a difference in the days after September 11, 2001, when the skies were free of jets?
Absolutely. What we did was take a look at the skies using satellite imagery first across the United States to try to determine if there were just general indications of unusually low cloudiness in situations where normally contrails form, again, out ahead of fronts and storm systems. And right away we saw indications of unusually crisp edges to the cloudiness that nature provides for us, and we knew something was missing. We knew the airplanes weren't in the sky. And then we started looking at the temperature data as a way to try to determine if any sort of signal could be found in the climate record for those 3 days that was an indicator of something unusual. And unusual being defined nowadays is no airplanes in the sky. And sure enough, we did find some significant results.
Now, the same sort of thing wouldn't have happened in the old days before jet travel. Propeller planes must pollute, don't they?
The propeller planes, there is such a thing as propeller-enhanced contrails, but not near as effectively. I mean, this is something that started popping up in World War II, really, when we first started seeing the use of jet engines not long thereafter, and it was a military problem for the longest amount of time as they were trying to use research as a way to avoid producing contrails, to not give away their locations to the enemy. But really, no, you're right. It wasn't a problem until the 1960s and forward, as the use of jet engines has increased dramatically since.
And you call this problem global dimming?
Well, it's a combination of effects. The global dimming issue is really looking at things that we're doing to reduce the amount of sunlight, direct sunlight striking the Earth's surface. And with airplanes, it's really two factors here. One is the clouds that we've been talking about, the contrails, which themselves can block out sunlight. And the other is this is pure pollution, the pollutants that are emitted from airplanes, not necessarily that produce clouds, but just pollutants, and also pollutants that come from the Earth's surface. And in some parts of the world where we're seeing sort of out-of-date use of technology for producing energy, we're seeing tremendous decreases, or we have at certain times tremendous decreases in the amount of sunlight striking the Earth. And you can just fly into some of these cities. All you have to do is fly into L.A. and you can see the smog and get an idea of what global dimming is from.
So if less sunlight is reaching the Earth, wouldn't that lead to a cooling effect?
Yes, that is the hypothesis. And it's
but aren't we talking about global warming right now, not global cooling?
Yeah, it's when we have flowers blooming in New York in late, early January, it does seem kind of an odd thought. The idea is that with global dimming, we could be having a cooling effect, but the global warming that is going on, it has been much stronger and has been able to offset that. And the concern is, and this is at least one hypothesis that's out there, is that as we make progress in cleaning the atmosphere, we're making more progress in cleaning the pollution out of the atmosphere that's causing global dimming. It may allow the global warming effect to dramatically increase. And we have made some serious progress here in the last decade or so in reducing the particulate pollution. And some scientists in my field feel like that's why we're seeing a more recent dramatic jump in global warming.
So global dimming could be a good thing because it counteracts global warming?
Well, I would never say that. I think that's been suggested, and people have even said at conferences that I've attended, at presentations, why don't we just take our time cleaning up the global dimming problem and buy some more time in solving this global warming issue? And to me, that's crazy. You know, it's allowing one problem to grow while trying to deal with another problem. I don't think there's anything good about the global dimming effect, if nothing else because the pollution that's causing it is also a health problem. I mean, we're breathing these pollutants in, and that's an entire different conversation that we have to deal with, though.
My guest is David Travis, a climatologist at the University of Wisconsin. For a moment, you had me feeling less guilty about flying in jets, and now I'm back to feeling guilty. I've also wondered about the effect of jets traveling through the thinner levels of the atmosphere. Do they degrade the stratosphere?
Well, one of the things that's been suggested with this contrail problem is why don't we just allow jets to fly higher in the drier, lower stratosphere? And that would definitely reduce the production of contrails. There wouldn't be enough moisture. But the problem with that is as we get above the 40,000-foot mark, and as technology has improved to allow us to do that, we're getting closer and closer to the ozone layer. And now we have an entirely different set of problems in that there are pollutants that are emitted from the exhaust that directly damage the ozone layer. So that's not really a good solution either.
Because then we will wind up we'll be back to the heating up problem, because if the ozone layer thins, then we're going to be getting we're going to be getting all sorts of things that will heat up the air, won't it, or heat up the Earth?
We certainly will get more ultraviolet radiation. There actually isn't a tremendous amount of heating that's created from that added UV radiation. It's more of an issue with skin cancer and cataracts and the sort of threats that too much ultraviolet radiation poses to the human body.
Now, how many planes are up there in the air at any given time anyway? Are we talking about something that is a huge number?
Well, the numbers, it's interesting you ask that question because we're trying to pin that, we've been trying to pin that down, and we're getting sort of mixed answers from the FAA and from some of the airlines. I don't exactly know. We're guesstimating somewhere around 10 to 15,000 at any given time here in the United States, but 25 to 30,000 flights a day minimum, and that number is growing. You're talking just the United States. Globally, again, the data is much more sparse, and we're not really sure what the final values are.
Are the airlines responding to your research?
I think we've had some success in conversations with some of the personnel at Boeing, as I think they do have an interest in sort of environmental impacts and trying to develop technologically in an environmentally conscious way. But where we haven't had much of a response and much luck really getting information is with the FAA and with some of the main airlines. I don't know if they feel like we're going to try to make them look bad, but honestly, all this is an effort to try to understand what's going on and try to look for solutions.
The FAA because of government policies today, or do you think the FAA, no matter what administration is in place?
Well, I think it's been more difficult because of the current administration. We did have some success getting information in the 90s, although it's hard to attribute necessarily whether it was the Clinton administration versus Bush, or whether what's happened since post 9/11. Since 9/11, we've had a hard time getting any sort of information of that sort. So it could be sort of a combination of the government that's in place now, as well as trying to be a little bit more protective of our data.
Now, temperature changes over the course of a day. Does that affect global dimming as well, the effects of these jets?
Yeah, it does in that, during the daytime, the global dimming effect is obviously going to be the only time when it's important because at night we don't have the sunlight. But it becomes quite complicated when we look at the issue of let's just say contrails for a second, because during the daytime, there is a dual effect going on with they're not only blocking sunlight, but they're also trapping energy below, sort of like greenhouse gases will do. And so you have these competing effects. And one of the things that we're trying to sift through is determining that net effect during the daytime of a warming versus a cooling. At night, there's no doubt that there's a warming going on because contrails are high clouds. They trap energy below, and they cause a warming effect. And one of the things we're trying to determine is what is this final net effect of the production of contrails? Is it that daytime slight cooling effect possibly, or is it the nighttime warming effect? And which one's changing? Because one of the things we've seen more recently is a rapid increase in nighttime flights. And if that nighttime flight increase continues, we're going to see more and more of a warming effect, which would enhance the global warming effect that we're seeing from greenhouse gases.
David Travis is a climatologist at the University of Wisconsin. Thank you so much for talking about that, or this whole matter with us. I had no idea.
That's my pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.